Thanks for listening to this podcast of APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show. Our collective focuses on issues relevant to APA communities and features an angry APA minute where listeners like you can sound off. We promote social justice, feature APA arts and culture, and challenge how APAs are represented in the media. If you have a story idea or would like to contribute, leave us a message on our Facebook page, APA Compass Radio. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of each month on Portland's KBOO 90.7 FM and at www.kboo.fm. Or you can download podcasts of our program at kboo.fm/APACOMPASS. That's kboo.fm/APACompass. Thanks again for listening.
Like a local rock track on some beats, rhymes, and life.
What up, y'all? Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to our February episode of APA Compass on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta, and part of our features from the Ray Warren Multicultural Symposium at Lewis and Clark College includes my interview with keynote speaker Baratunde Thurston. Baratunde Thurston was the director of digital at the satirical newspaper The Onion and is a speaker and writer on issues concerning race. He is the author of How to Be Black, a memoir on race and growing up in the nation's capital. Baratunde was given this Nigerian name by his so-called hippie mother. The name means one who is chosen and seemed fitting after she had miscarried 9 times before. Besides his name, his upbringing included attending Sidwell Friends School, the prestigious institution which currently hosts the Obama Girls, and attending Ankobia, a pro-African heritage program for black youth. At the same time, Baratunde experienced living in a pre-gentrified neighborhood in Washington, D.C. These experiences and interviews with other writers are included in his book, How to Be Black. The cover is plain, the title is in giant block letters, and can be seen from several yards away. He often challenges readers to read the book in public and force people to glance or stare, and perhaps open up a dialogue on race. I myself read this book while commuting on TriMet. Baratunde and I began our discussion when I inquired about his thoughts on, quote, hipster racism, which manifests in ways such as, oh, I can say this offensive remark because I'm not really racist.
Yeah. So people say that in their comfortable environments. And there's an assertion of privilege and trust in statements like that. It comes up in comedy some too. You have people doing like really racist material, very aggressive and edgy material and saying, I can do this because it's comedy. Therefore, it's okay to say whatever I want. And you just haven't paid your dues to be able to assert that level of freedom.
What are the dues?
Living somewhere, getting beat up, understanding, having friends from, listening. We can't all actually walk in everyone else's shoes. That's labor intensive. That's an unreasonable request and expectation. But there's a shortcut. You know, people are skipping over a lot of levels. It's like a video game. And everybody just wants to go straight to the boss level, right? And just take on the boss at the end. It's like, no, you can't get to that part. You got to go find the key. You got to talk to save the princess. You got to like fall in the pit a couple of times and lose your life like 3 times and then go look up the code on the internet. Like you don't just skip to the end. You don't just get a college degree. You got to like learn how to read first. So I think there's a lot of people who've been skipping the elementary phases of sort of the language of race and certainly the flippant treatment of racism assumes a certain intimate relationship. It's the language and a relationship. So in the relationship context, it's like the first date you want to have sex. Like immediately. Like it's like, hi, we're banging. Like, no, you don't, even in these loose times with the youth, you know, and whatever they're doing. I read about stuff on Tumblr. That's too much, right? You got to at least buy a beer. You know what I'm saying? You got to put something. You got to invest something. And you don't just get to collect with no investment of great conversation. Put some effort into the way you dress. Spend some money. Listen a little bit. So that's a bit rough. So people got to go to school a little bit more. And that's, and I think, the frustration with the, like, oh, I can just say this because, you know, it's ironic. It's like, no, you're really doing a disservice to the level of pain involved in this whole thing. And it is not merely around for your rhetorical amusement. There's actual outcomes and lives and quality of life and health in the balance. And it is disrespectful to ignore all that.
You had mentioned on several occasions that everybody needs a black friend. Every white person needs a black friend. Maybe you mean everybody, but I'm not sure if you mean you need one or you need at least one or a group. But I kind of wanted to challenge you on that because mm-hmm. I understand why you need that cultural liaison. But what I have found in my experiences is that being the token person in someone else's life means that you represent their worldview, and that's not good.
Yeah.
That's dangerous. So I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, what we really should have is an exchange program, like study abroad, but here. And you can do it even within the city. You don't have to go traveling overseas. You don't have to cross the country. You don't even have to go north to south. But you could just swap people. It doesn't have to be all white people, because that's a lot of people. And that just gets expensive, and I'm sensitive to budgetary constraints. But if you got some key white people, the influencers that they hold sway over their peers, and you just yank them out of their world and throw them elsewhere. Throw them in the hood, throw them in another country, throw them around poor people if they're rich, like just break it up a little bit and let them feel it. Then they'll come back and they'll be like, oh, I get it now. And so I don't think everybody needs a black friend unless there's some kind of subsidy going on. And that's a jobs program for black friendship. And you can kind of apply to be a black friend. And I could do that. I've kind of done it for a while. But I'd want some serious pay at this point because I'm so good. So yeah, the idea of putting that burden on one person, and that being the person of color, the black person, is a bit much. I agree with you on that. I just want white people to do it now. I just want them to do everything now. I want them to pick up. I want them to be like, racism's terrible. We must fight it. I want straight people to be like, yo, homophobia is terrible. We must, like, just everybody just switch roles. And give the folks, give the oppressed people a break and just let them chill for a minute. Maybe go to Club Med or something and just have a great hoedown. Something approaching that is a level of like radical experimentation that would be a lot of fun to imagine and try to get at in some more practical ways. Putting it all on the black friend, that's probably too much.
A little bit. Speaking of switching roles and putting too much responsibility on the black friend, mm-hmm. We have this president who's been reelected.
Yes, he has.
And I remember when he was campaigning or back when he was senator that there was a lot of flack that he's not really African-American. He's not really black. He's not black enough. He's not this or that or the other. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, he gets flack for being it. So I was wondering if you had any commentary on that.
Yeah, it's an impossible position to be in. And America is dumb from time to time and overly demanding and inconsistent. So there's probably a good diagram of this. There's the not black enough versus too black. And then there's who's saying it, black people versus non-black people. And so in the black people saying he's not black enough, that was early on, and that was from political competition. That was from, you know, old civil rights leaders, idiots, former mayor of Atlanta, ambassador, civil rights hero, just destroying his legacy by saying things like Bill Clinton is as black as Barack Obama. He looks like an idiot now, and I hope history records that as well. So from a black person to him, that's supposed to be a negative, and it's a diss. It's like, oh, you're not really one of us, and you're not just people. Oh, he's not really descended from slaves, so he doesn't have slave blood in him, so he's not real black. And it's like, oh, okay, that's just exhausting and stupid, and people aren't really saying that anymore, thank God. But it was really exhausting for that year, like mm-hmm. when the believability of his substantial campaign had yet to be accepted. They were just like, oh, Hawaii's not, no, there's no black people in Hawaii. It's just a terrible banner to wave, like the no, we can't. Given that his campaign was all like, yes, we can, it was exceptionally sad. Then you have white people who, when they say it, they are either trying to drive a wedge or they're being complimentary. And like, oh, he's not really black. Look at his Harvard degree. He's not one of them. He's one of the good ones. Look how articulate, accomplished, and And so the backhanded compliment is itself, you know, diss and disrespectful and silly. And then, you know, so that was before. And generally, as he rose to prominence, the comments were that he wasn't really that black. But then it was this really quick switch. And the Reverend Wright moment just, like, brought it out of the woodwork. Now, not only was he super-duper black, he was, like, he's actually Kenyan. He's African and a Muslim and, like, a terrorist. And he hates, he's so black, he hates America. This non-slave descendant, right? It's just totally inconsistent with the other meme that was running. It's like he's just bitter about all the wrongs that America may probably didn't do. America's never done wrong because America doesn't apologize. But let's hypothetically say America may have done some unkind things to his non-ancestors. He's really pissed about that and palled around with terrorists.
I mean, this is a politician, so people are going to find anything and everything to pick on him and to make ridiculous comments. But it was representing a whole.
Yeah, and I think what was difficult and to his governing is that the level of insanity at the edge prevented some reasonable discussion in the middle. So when the president does things that are not fun to watch, you know, whether it's like drone things or civil liberties abuses, it's cool to be critical of that. But then like those crazy right-wing people are like, he's a monkey. And you're like, okay, well, if you're going to fucking call him a monkey, I'm going to defend him now. Like, you've left no reasonable space for actual discussion because you went straight to bullshit racism. And that hyper-extended reaction is, you know, there's just so much undealt with rage that you just see bubbling up and flashing and lashing out at this, like, Obama's become this lightning rod for all these grievances that are economically based. And there's no fact in it. That's just the impression that they have because things aren't going great and it must be a zero-sum world. He's black now, super black guy, and he's just handing out federal cash to black people. I saw this comment last week on someone I ended up having to block on Facebook. He had been a troll for a long time. So I clicked through to see his profile because he had said something really horrible about Hurricane Sandy and the response, and he displayed a lack of compassion, which I thought was like unacceptable. And I went through his page and I found more things like that from him and his other friends, and people like, oh, you know, who doesn't keep more than 2 days worth of food in their house? They're probably just spending it all on their welfare checks Obama gave them. Wow. There's a dark, dark, dark side to this country that often comes out on the internet.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to APA Compass on KABU. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is an interview with Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black, an insightful and hilarious memoir on Black America. The book features conversations with various writers and their experiences with race. In the second half of this interview, we continued our discussion regarding the failed attempt at dialogues on race, such as terms like colorblind and post-racial.
Well, talking about being too black or not black enough, or there's a lot of food-related terms that people have. In my community, they use the term coconut, meaning you're brown on the outside, you're white on the inside.
Yeah, you got coconut.
Because we're a tropical people. Bananas. So I think, so in your community, they use the term Oreo. And so talk about judging identity. Do we have the right to do that? Or how do we do that? And why do we do that?
Well, we do it out of a self-preservation sort of defense mechanism of protect the tribe, the homeland. Like if you're a part of a persecuted group, you can't really. Touré writes about this very well in his book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? He talks about how we were so on the defense for so long, we couldn't afford to let people express themselves in a different way because we had to like stay together. And that meant culturally stay together. And that meant, this is black, we can't trust you otherwise. Like could be one of them. It's not helpful. And it's, you know, very illegitimate. Like, Clarence Thomas isn't any less black. He's wrong. You know, like, I don't think Herman Cain isn't black. I think he's an idiot. And when you know, Cornel West did it the other way around to Obama, he, like, you know, got really ugly in the past 2 years with his criticism. And he basically said, this guy's not black. And he said, oh, he's, you know, he's getting come from these white parents that hangs around Jews all the time. He got really petty. And no, Obama's still black. He just does something you disagree with. Like, you can just be wrong. It doesn't have to be a betrayal of your race that dilutes your membership in that race. Like, yeah, I think the policies of, like, Michael Steele as running the Republican Party, not that great for black people. Doesn't make him less black. We just need to separate concentration of blackness within a soul versus like what the impact of their actions are.
Related to this, these movements like post-racial and colorblind. So it's okay. Expand on that. On that grunt.
Yeah, no, that's as articulate as I can be about something that is about as meaningful as blah. So whenever somebody says post-racial, you just translate that into and then you're like, what was that? Exactly. I didn't say anything. That's a quaint idea. As I have a whole chapter about it, and I interviewed people about it, and everybody had the same response, which is, it's bullshit. And, you know, thankfully the rhetoric around it is much diminished. There was a study came out about a month ago, within the past month, I should say, from AP, I think. It tested racial attitudes in the U.S. since, you know, the president's first election. So yeah, post-racial, colorblind, not helpful, not useful, not, you know, there's no learning there. There's a burying one's head in the sand instead of hoping problems go away. And there's damage in doing it in that we have problems in the world and in this country, certainly, that are heavily related to the race of the people who are suffering from these problems. And if we act like, well, race just doesn't exist, then we're missing a likely key factor in what separates, you know, positive outcomes for people in a country that's supposed to be able to provide for all its people. So that's the harm that comes from aspiring to post-racialness and certainly declaring it well before we're anywhere.
And especially with this multicultural symposium, we're talking about being the spokespeople of talking about minorities and communities, mm-hmm. race, ethnicity, and culture. And I always wonder who really has the right to do that, because it ends up being a lot of power over people who either cannot or won't speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, I had to figure out how I was articulating this, but I think I have something like, what do you have to say about being a spokesperson on behalf of a community? Yeah. Do we have the right to represent this community? Who has the right to define a community and advocate for a community?
Well, if you are duly elected, you actually have the right, right? If there have been ballots and some kind of democratic process. Or if you just have a lot of force and you threaten people with guns and stuff, then I guess you have the right of force to represent yourself. I am in neither of those positions and claim no explicit representation. I mean, I guess I speak for all humans. If the aliens come, I would volunteer to go and like negotiate on behalf, because I feel like I got a pretty good grip on like what it means to be a person, biologically and emotionally and stuff. So if it happens, you guys can call me up. I will serve. But in terms of speaking for black people or for whatever people, the folks who step forward just get it. They just get the jobs to do it, like in the media, et cetera. Or there is a...
Oh, writing a book about how to be black.
Yeah, that's different, though. That's different. I think that, I mean, there's obviously a limit to what one person can see, interpret, and represent. Like, you have to have a level of access. You have to have a level of, like, interest. And it's just physically impossible to represent everybody through one person. It's convenient to have a person to go to for the establishment of any kind, for any institution. You'd be like, oh, it's Martin Luther King. That's the dude. He didn't represent all black people. There were a ton of black people who thought he was a troublemaker. And she just shut up. leave it alone. Let these white folks do their thing. We're going to do our thing over here. And, you know, you go through some of the more prominent media figures over the decades, usually dudes. What is fascinating now to me is that, I mean, if you really want to, like, speak for people and be like, I'm representing this whole thing, you got to go and listen to them and kind of gain their trust so that they're like, yeah, this dude speaks for us. You certainly, and I speak for me, and I speak very loudly, and I think I speak for people who have been like me with an implicit understanding, like, yeah, we had a life kind of like that. That dude, like, there's not a lot of people protesting the things I'm saying because I'm, like, vastly misrepresenting or misrepresenting is the word I was looking for. But what I was really getting at is the idea of funneling experience through single points of expression, i.e. a spokesperson, is less necessary these days because everybody's got their own megaphones and has got their own broadcasting facilities in their hands. They got their phones, they got computers, and not every single person, but most, by and large, and more than ever in history. So there's another interesting opportunity to listen to what those folks are saying and also just let those folks speak for themselves, whoever they are. And instead of being like, oh yeah, we think black people think what that person on cable news says, like, oh, you just go see what black people are saying because they're talking. And a very discoverable medium known as the internet, partially. And I think that's useful. There's also, on the politics side of things, there is a way to structure that leadership such that it is in tune with the grassroots more and actually like goes community by community and block by, like, listens and organizes. That's a lot of work that a lot of people don't want to do. Shortcuts, again, we love them. The country rewards shortcuts, and that makes some sense economically, not always politically. So those are my thoughts on spokespersonness. And just for the record, I'm not trying to be a spokesperson for Black America. I'll be a spokesperson for Earth. It's a bigger game.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. A
little bit more responsible.
Set your sights higher.
Thank you so much, Baritone de Thurston, for chatting with me.
Thank you very much for being chattable unto.
That was Baritone Thurston, the comedic author of the memoir, How to Be Black. Baritone Thurston was the keynote speaker at the annual Ray Warren Multicultural Symposium at Lewis and Clark College last November, when this interview was recorded. You can follow Baritone on Facebook and Twitter and learn more about the annual symposium at the Lewis and Clark College website. I'm Sari Gametta, and you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The sound against the shores of the suicide capital. Bust the magical dust, grammatically just a satellite. What makes Seattle tight? The fruits have been ripened.